The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, I'm jealous. You're in the Bahamas, and here I sit. We have 3 feet of snow outside on the ground.
I'm simply glad to be here. I'll put my toes in the sand if I get the chance in the next couple of days. Also, in the next couple of days, Kevin, we've got Bert Doman, who'll be joining us here in the Bahamas for this conference. And, Kevin, one of the reasons we have him on the program regularly is he's a veteran. He's been around. He's seen a lot. He's been thinking and writing and actively involved in the markets for the better part of 40 years.
He's been very, very accurate as well, has he not?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the insights that he has and his opinions are extra valuable to us with the wisdom of experience behind them. So, Bert Doman, I'm here in the Bahamas waiting for your arrival. We've got the conference coming up this next weekend and week, and look forward to spending some time one-on-one with you. Before that, we know that there's a number of people who won't be able to make the conference here, and I'd love for them to get your opinion on a couple of issues. We've looked at 2009 in retrospect here in recent weeks, and a look ahead at 2010, and would love for you to weigh in on some of the issues that we thought would be very significant.
Yeah, it's really nice to speak with you at this long distance and keep a nice cold beer cold for me. I'll be there soon, and then we'll go swimming with the sharks.
Perfect. I feel like we do that every day when we turn on the Bloomberg machine and try to navigate these waters. What's really interesting, Bert, is that the risk appetite has seemed to come back into the market here in the first few weeks of 2010. Junk bonds, emerging markets, commodities, these were the hot issues for 2009. Do you think we'll see the same thing for 2010?
You know, David, this is what I've been looking at exactly. The risk has gone out of the market again. The spread of junk bond yields over treasury yields, everything that you look at, the participation, all speculative activities, the amount of leverage on Wall Street has soared again. It's as if we hadn't had a crash at all. The same feeling is there that there's no risk in all of these trades. And that is because during Greenspan's time, we had what was called the Greenspan put. And that basically meant that we can speculate as long as we want to. If there is a problem, Greenspan will bail us out. Now we have, in my opinion, the Bernanke put. They have put several $1 trillion into the system. They have bailed out everyone, not just financial institutions. And that means that the big trading outfits are once again sure that we will not have another recurrence of the financial crisis, and therefore you can take big risks with huge leverage and not have a problem. And now, of course, you can do this with even much cheaper money, money that costs you maybe 0.25%, and therefore the potential profits are even bigger. When you take a look at the bonuses being handed out on Wall Street now, it is absolutely incredible, as if we hadn't had the financial crisis in 2008 whatsoever. And usually these kind of things always end very, very badly, and I think we're just about there.
Well, it seems that with the current volume in the New York Stock Exchange being 70% to 80% dominated by high-frequency quant trading, that we're really not looking at investors in mass having come back into the market. In fact, it seems almost that there's a mirage. There seems to be health, seems to be activity, seems to be a reemergence of positive earnings from your Fortune 500 companies. I guess the question is what seems truly reality, or do we have the reassertion of a longer-term bear market?
Yes, what we had was nothing but a bear market rally, which is very, very normal. You compare the charts of this rally and the crash that preceded it with what happened in the early 1930s, it's almost identical. We had a relief rally from the crash. It started last March 6th. That was the very day of the bottom, and we closed out all of our short positions on that day. Then we went long a couple of days later in our services. Now, you never know how long a bear market rally like that will last. But in my view, the internal top was in October, mid-October, because that's where our indicators, many of our indicators really topped out. Since that time, the major indices have continued to rise very slowly, but on declining volume. According to Charles Biederman of TrimTap, he said, this is the biggest rally we've ever seen in the history of the stock market, accompanied by declining volume. And as every technical analyst knows, any rally, whether it's in the stock market or stock or real estate, any investment area, a rally that takes place on declining value is very, very dangerous, because once the rally is over, the plunge is usually very fast, very sharp, and very painful. What you're creating is basically, as the market continues to rise with fewer people willing to pay the higher prices, you're creating a vacuum underneath the prices. And sooner or later, that vacuum is filled. And this one will be filled as well. And that's why this current situation is a wonderful opportunity for people who know how to make money in a bear market. And as you know, in 2008, our subscribers made a lot of money on the short side. And we're going to do it again this year. There's really not much to hope for on the long side.
Well, I'm glad we have your company in our management services. We've put into the short side of the market already, and think that 2010 is an interesting year for that for many reasons. Now, the question is often asked by our clients, you know, the direction of the dollar. We've been in a long-term bear market for the dollar. We've come off of 120, gotten as low as 72, rallied to nearly 90. And, you know, certainly if you look at the long-term chart of the dollar, there's room for it to rally significantly again. So I know that's something that you've been looking at. The question is, since many of our investors are interested in the gold market, the question is, does a dollar rally, is it axiomatic that a dollar rally crushes the gold market, or are there other commodities that are more likely to suffer?
Yes, David, the dollar is going to be the big story this year, in my opinion. At the end of November, we got bullish on the dollar. We said that's going to be the big surprise from now on, a rising dollar. And a rising dollar really confirms our view on the stock market. As you know, in 2008, the U.S. stock market had a major crash. And at the same time, the U.S. dollar had a major rally. So if the same correlation still works, and there were good reasons for that correlation, and those same reasons still exist in my view, then a declining stock market should be accompanied by a rising dollar. And then you have to say, okay, what are the repercussions? In the January 5th Wellington letter, we had these outlined. That was our view for this year, for 2010. And we said the dollar will rally, the stock market will decline, and with the dollar rally, all commodity prices, all of the hot markets of last year will tumble. That means emerging market stocks, emerging market bonds, commodities. The big question mark is really gold. And I would say there's maybe a 30% chance that the precious metals will be able to kind of resist the plunge in the commodities prices, or the decline will be less than other commodities. But still, I consider it at this point a very high risk unless we can hedge the position and say, fine, we don't care about what's going to happen over this year. We'll take the five-year view. We think in 5 years from now, the precious metals should be higher. And I have that belief.
So from a longer-term perspective, and for an investor, not necessarily a trader, you wouldn't be concerned having a metals position. Let me run this past you and see what your thought is, because certainly as the dollar increases in value, if you're right about a 2010 prediction that the dollar rallies significantly, we should see foreign currencies under a tremendous amount of pressure. Now, what does that do for the gold price in those foreign currencies and the audience that we have globally for gold?
Exactly, and that's the point I made last year as well. The fact that the gold market, you know, the last big bull market in gold in the late 1970s was really a U.S. a driven gold market. Everybody's trying to hedge against the declining dollar at that time and chaos and high inflation in the U.S., Jimmy Carter, etc. But now it's really a global play. China has very little gold as a percentage of their reserves. I think it's about 2%. They would have to increase their holdings of gold at least fivefold in order to get where other central banks are. So there is a lot of pent-up demand for gold, as an alternative to paper money. And that is why I consider it a question mark. And yes, you and I and everybody else can make a guess, but we really don't know what kind of an effect it will have. And that's why I say, you know, it's the initial response, I believe, in gold will be bearish, and it will go down with commodities. But I think that somewhere along the way, gold will part company with the other commodities, and the other commodities will continue to decline sharply. And that includes copper, which everybody seems to love, and gold will start moving upward.
Well, in terms of unemployment, we have pretty nasty position here in the United States, certainly not as bad as Spain and some of your other European countries. But with U6 being over 17%, U3, the common number proffered, being still over 10%, double digit, it was interesting. Paul Krugman observed that, you know, it took us a year to go from 7.2% to 10.2%, and he thought that it would take us a decade. If we started now adding 300,000 jobs per month, we could potentially get it down to 8%, down to 8% by 2020. My question would be this: will we ultimately see unemployment worse than the 1930s, north of 25% officially?
Well, do you mean top line growth or U6 growth?
U6.
U6, around 17 already. If you calculated the way we did in 1980, then we're actually at 22% right now, a little over 22%. And you can get that number from shadowstats.com. And one thing that most people don't know is that President Clinton, you know, the person who said, you know, it depends on what your definition of the word is. Well, he found also a new definition for unemployed. If you haven't had a job for 1 year, you are no longer counted as unemployed, even in the U6 number. So if you add those people back in there, people who haven't worked for a year or more, then you get over 22% unemployment right now. So I think we're already pretty close to what we saw in the Great Depression. In fact, many statistics are now worse than in the Great Depression. If you take a look at international trade, in the first year of the Great Depression, international trade, which is really a very good indicator of a global depression, at that time, international trade plunged 15%, 1.5. In the first year of the current recession, that's the official word, I call it a depression, international trade dropped 32%. Now, that is huge. When you take a look at credit contraction, many of the credit indicators that I look at, like commercial and industrial loans, bank credit, retail credit, credit card credit, etc., they have plunged now 20 to 30% in the last year. This is something, I mean, usually I remember other big recessions, if we would see a drop in credit of 2 or 3%, it seemed horrendous. Now we're counting between 20 and 30%. This is like the Great Depression and worse.
Now, the bulls, and perhaps you might call them Pollyannas at some point, would say, yes, well, maybe that's true, but now we can say that the worst is behind us. And with those bad statistics, we can look at 2010 and 2011. I mean, we're at the bottom. We can only go up from here. And how do you respond?
I respond in that we are in a long-term depressionary situation, very much like Japan. In Japan, they've been in it now for 19 years, almost 20 years. And in 2007, I predicted that it would last until at least 2017. That gives us a 17-year downturn from what I consider the top, which was in the year 2000, not the 2007. So the year 2000, internally, you look at a lot of economic numbers and so on, was the real top in the long-term, the secular cycle. And so usually these last at least 17 years, the minimum. And so I said the first chance for a sustainable bottom will be in 2017. So when you have such wealth destruction as we are seeing now, when you have such a contraction in international trade and credit and everything, you cannot have a big recovery. What does a recovery require? Well, actually, the U.S. situation is very similar to Europe because they're all making the same mistakes. But you cannot have a recovery if there's no job creation, okay? And there is no job creation. There cannot be any job creation when you continue to raise taxes, when you continue to every day our great leader goes on a microphone and has more regulations. What entrepreneur in his right mind would start a new business right now or even hire more people under these circumstances of rising taxes, rising regulations, and the inability to get credit? That's the second thing you need, is credit growth. Without credit growth, you cannot have economic growth. In some of the big recessions that we've had in the past, when everybody's saying, oh, here comes the recovery. And I said, no way. Look at credit growth. Just look at the charts. You can get them free from the Federal Reserve. There's no credit growth. Therefore, we don't have a recovery yet. And then we'll take another 2 years before recovery started. And then we would say, credit growth is starting. Now we can look forward to a recovery. And then we would have the recovery. As long as you don't have credit growth, you cannot have an economic recovery. It's impossible.
So when we turn on CNBC, when we turn on Bloomberg, and the talking heads encourage us with great stories of turnaround and recovery, it sounds to me like you would just say it's unmitigated balderdash. That's simply not true.
Look at who are the most of these people. They're talking their book. They work for Wall Street firms, or they're money managers, or they're mutual fund managers. How can anybody managing a mutual fund be bearish on the market unless he has a short fund, right?
Right.
He cannot be. He can't say, I'm bearish on the market is going to go down, because then people will say, why are you investing our money in the market? And they blew him.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
We just finished an interesting conference down in Mexico City and spent some time with a number of wonderful, wonderful people, CEOs from throughout Latin America and particularly Mexico. And one of the things that we walked away with was from the discussion was that Europe is in much worse condition than the United States, where their Tier 1 capital ratios are significantly lower. They have a different accounting, accrual accounting, which is quite different from the U.S., where we have mark-to-market some of our assets. They don't have to mark-to-market any of their assets. So they live with a fiction. They haven't marked down any of their bad loans. They don't have capital raised, and we're potentially going into an environment where it'll be impossible to raise capital, very much like 2008. Should we focus more of our attention on Europe, the European markets, than perhaps the U.S.? I mean, are we the winner on a relative basis, or would you say, no, we can't step outside of this particular vortex?
No, I think the entire world is synchronized. It's just a matter of who's worse, who's going to go down worse than the next guy. In Spain, their equivalent of the U6 unemployment rate in the U.S. is actually 34%. So they have 34% unemployed people in Spain. Okay, now, China is supposedly booming. This is a totally, totally false boom. This is like what we had in 2006 and 2007. The central bank just putting so much money into the system, basically forcing the banks, which are all partially owned by the government, to make the loans. So they already have 40% vacancy factors in many brand new buildings, condos and office buildings and so on, and they continue to build new ones because the bank goes to a developer and says, look, I'll give you so and so many bajillion dollars or one, and just go build another building. And, you know, developers like Pavlov's dog, you know, you give him money and he builds, whether he can sell it or not.
Well, it reminds me a lot, Bert, of Dubai, because there were so many people coming back from Dubai 3 or 4 years ago who just, I mean, it was almost like they had seen something miraculous happen when they came back from the Middle East. It was just this, it was the eighth wonder of the world. It was going to be the Wall Street of the Middle East. There just was no way to hold back this dynamic growth, when in fact, it was really a credit mirage. And
exactly.
It was credit mimicking the miraculous. And I've wondered, because I haven't spent very much time in China at all, but you have that same sort of etherized view of China. It's amazing. It's unbelievable.
Exactly.
You can't stop the growth in China. It's the next Japan. Well, the question is, is it really the next Japan in terms of creating overcapacity and launching itself into a tailspin?
In Dubai at that time, in 2007, 25% of all of the construction cranes in the world were in Dubai. They were all working in Dubai. And at that time, as you know, I wrote in the Wellington letter, I said, this is going to be the greatest real estate fiasco in the history of mankind. all of Dubai will eventually be one big ghost town. And I think we're on the way to that. And in China, we're seeing the same thing. I just got an email from a friend of mine of the opulence in China. And here were a few weddings. You should have seen all the Rolls Royces, the Lamborghinis, the Ferraris, and then all the little kids driving them. They must have all been under the age of 25. They were their cars, okay? So, seemed like Wall Street in 2007?
Well, it certainly feels like either Wall Street in 2007 or Dubai just in recent years. It is credit, the response to credit. The market does anything and everything that it can. It's free money. It's being handed out, and what do you do with something like that? Just take it as a gift, as if from the gods.
You know, free money or cheap money, it always causes huge dislocations, and that has to be paid for later on. If you take a look at iron ore right now, I was just reading a report from China, and iron ore is piling up big, big rates in the ports of China. Okay, so they've been buying all of this stuff, the iron ore and the copper and all of the basic materials. They've been buying up and stockpiling them, and the anticipation apparently is of the bureaucrats over there that the recession is temporary and that during the next boom, these prices will go much, much higher. Well, you know, bureaucrats, in my experience, have never been all that great in forecasting commodity prices or anything. And therefore, if the boom that they expect doesn't come, all of that stuff is going to be sitting there. It won't be used.
Here in the U.S., we've got something very interesting relating back to credit. While there's an excess credit still taking place in China, here, you look at our velocity measures, and money is not being lent at the bank level. Maybe you want to explore that a little bit. As you mentioned, without the credit flowing, the growth and the recovery cannot occur.
Money velocity is a very important and often overlooked indicator. In 2007, I said you were going to see a plunge in money velocity. And in 2008, I wrote about that again when the Fed started putting all this money into the system and so on. And I said the plunge in velocity will not allow all these bailouts to be inflationary. And I guess this is where I part ways with a lot of my esteemed colleagues in the business. Of course, no one can know for sure, but I just, you know, I've done a lot of work on this. In the late 1970s, you know, everyone was talking about hyperinflation around the corner, and I said, no way. It's just not possible under these conditions. This time around, I think, you know, looking out 5 to 10 years, yes, I think you could probably make a good case for very high inflation rates, but not over the next several years. And the reason is that money velocity has just plunged. And that means that the turnover of money in the economy has slowed down so drastically. People are keeping their money longer because they need the money. They don't have the money anymore. So they're keeping it longer. And if money doesn't circulate and the banks are not lending and people are not borrowing, then the Federal Reserve and the central bank in other countries, they basically have a situation which they call, you know, pushing on a string. They're pushing all this money into the system, but it isn't going anywhere from the banks. The banks are not putting the money out. They're not creating loans. And under these conditions, you cannot have hyperinflation. But, of course, that can change. Once you do get an inkling of an economic recovery, then you really have to start being careful. But we're not seeing that. I think China has a much greater chance of inflationary condition than the U.S.
You think we're still in sort of the deleveraging stage here in the U.S.? I mean, we look at our Fed balance sheet, and it's bloated with $2.2 trillion worth of garbage paper. And how much more can they monetize? I guess one of the questions in the inflation camp is a tremendous amount of debt continues to be produced. Who is going to buy it? Our foreign creditors are not as interested as they once were, and will have their own problems to deal with, if we're right, specifically with China. And Japan's already got more than their fair share of issues to deal with. Who buys our treasuries, if not the Fed? And in that quantitative easing, quote-unquote, or direct monetization effort, when does that end up looking and feeling a lot more like the inflationary 1970s?
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem. Eventually, this is not going to be financeable. It isn't even at this point because the Federal Reserve is buying most of the governmental securities that are being offered. And the Federal Reserve right now is basically doing 80 to 90% of the mortgage financing in the country indirectly. The GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the FHA, they're doing the financing, and then they package these mortgages and sell it to the Fed.
Well, how do they not do that this next year? How do they not do that in 2011? I mean, you would crater the real estate market if you stepped away. They were buying $100 billion worth of mortgage paper per month this last year. Talk about propping up a market, and yet you can't have your average homeowner feel glum and gloomy about their primary asset. I mean, they're really in a tough place because they have to continue to buy. And if they don't, then we realize what an awful situation we're in.
David, you are so right. This is just like a drug addict. You know, he continues to need that fix. The moment you take the needle away from him for a longer time, he goes into these very painful withdrawal symptoms. And that's the only way this is going to end. If they withdraw earlier, it's going to be less painful than if they withdraw later. Because they are just basically taking all of the private debt and making it a public debt. It doesn't change the debt. The only thing that can change the debt is the defaults, okay? Loan defaults, and then suddenly you've got this deleveraging, you've got less debt in the system, and then we can get back down to a base, and the phoenix can rise again out of the ashes, and it would be ashes. So right now we have a situation where they really cannot withdraw, and I know, what is the end of March, I think, they're supposedly stopping the financing of the mortgages and so on. They're not going to do it. They're going to prolong it again because they know they cannot withdraw it. They are the market. The government and the Federal Reserve, they are the financial markets right now. They're buying commercial paper. They're buying commercial mortgages. They're buying residential mortgages. Everything in sight. The government is the only ballgame.
Now you've got Obama, who is now talking tough just before the State of the Union about cuts in spending and getting very aggressive in budgetary matters. Is this kind of a response to the Massachusetts referendum just not long ago where the Ted Kennedy seat is lost to a Republican? Is he getting a little desperate? As I understand it, the cuts in spending that he's suggesting equate to saving, if you were to go out and buy a $3,000 retail purchase, it'd save you like $10-15. So they are real cuts, but not real big cuts. What is this?
David, I learned long ago that you cannot believe anything any politician says. So I don't even listen to what they say. They say what they think people want to hear, but not what they believe. They don't say what they're going to do. You always have to look behind the scenes and see what their agenda is. And when you look a little bit closer, then the agenda is not very encouraging at all.
Is it likely that we could see, in the midst of our inability to finance our own bills, nobody's loaning us money, we're creating bookkeeping entries to make it appear that we're still functioning in a healthy way, is it possible that in that context the administration could get desperate and start some degree of capital controls, introducing flow of funds out of the United States from foreigners or for U.S. citizens, you just can't take your money out, as kind of a preemptive move to a significant dollar decline? We may have a dollar rally in here. I don't think you're in a camp that would see the dollar as a long-term winner, maybe a short-term winner, but not necessarily over the next 2, 3, 4 years. At what point do policy measures just get nasty in terms of their impact to you and me, the investor or the man in the street?
Well, regarding the dollar will continue to rise as long as the international financial system is crumbling, and that could still take some time. There's this huge dollar carry trade. It used to be the yen carry trade, but now everybody's switched to the dollar carry trade. So these big trading operations, with a leverage of about 100-1, they borrow the dollar at 0.25% interest, and they use that money and let's say buy 10-year treasury notes or 30-year treasury bonds yielding 3.5%. That's a beautiful game to play with a leverage of 100-1. You're really making huge, huge profit. The only problem is with a leverage of 100-1, if the trade goes against you by 1%, your equity is wiped out, and then the problem starts. So we've had about a 7% dollar rally so far since the end of November. So that means someone with 100-1 leverage being short the dollar would have lost 7 times his equity. And there are literally, trillions of dollars in this trade. And that will take a long time to unwrap itself. And in the meantime, of course, the continued covering of short positions in the dollar will fuel a dollar rally. And then you, on top of that, is the international financial system is under great stress, the dollar becomes a safe haven currency. I warned about this in late November already. We've had a period of weeks where over $1 trillion went into 90-day treasury bills at zero yield and even negative yield. Negative yield means that people were actually paying for the privilege of parking their money into treasury bills. And I said, this is very, very strange. In my opinion, it was forewarning of something really bad is starting to happen in 2010, where you wanted to park your money in the safest instrument in the world and forget about yield and just say, I want my money to be safe. And that's where we are now.
So are we talking about something of a cataclysmic nature? I mean, are we talking about another financial meltdown as a result of a sovereign default? Are we talking about conflict between Iran and Israel? I mean, what do you think trillions of dollars chasing negative yields is trying to anticipate? Something of a geopolitical nature?
You know, I had three alternative explanations for that at the time. And I said, one is a terrorist attack. And we had that several weeks later when the underwear bomber was caught. But imagine if he had not been caught, we would have had an airplane fall out of the sky over Detroit and 300 people dead in the airplane and how many more people on the ground. It would have been really a significant terrorist attack. I said, and you know, before 9/11, you could tell in the stock market there were people well-connected who knew what was coming and they were selling short like crazy because we got sell signals on everything. We were short going into that, into 9/11 just because of market action. But you could tell that there was knowledge of what was going to happen. And who's to say? I mean, Osama bin Laden, he's from one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. So having said that, the other alternative was a military conflict. I think Israel really has no choice but to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran. They have no choice. Our policies in Washington right now are totally anti-Israel. We're trying to bludgeon them into submission against the terrorists. And you cannot do that, as history has shown, with Israel. And Israel is going to fight for its survival, and it really is a matter of survival for Israel. So in my opinion, they have no alternative but to bomb those facilities. And that will, of course, cause major upheaval, I think, in the financial markets and in a political arena. So, unfortunately, nobody can predict the future. We don't have a crystal ball. We can only guess at why all of this money, over $1 trillion, is going into treasury bills with zero yield. There must be an important reason.
Well, I think as we look at 2010, this is the real challenge of managing assets, either personally or professionally. There's really, as you said, no crystal ball. You do all of your homework. You continue to reanalyze, reassess, and turn over every stone you can, looking for some nugget of wisdom, some particular insight into market action. And we appreciate you being a part of that process, joining us again early in the year, and hope you'll join us again later in the year. We'll check back in and see how we're doing. Seems like a great time to be focusing on asset preservation. There will be a brighter day to be investing, and we hope that you can give us some insight again next time we're on the line with you. Look forward to seeing you here in a couple of days down in the Bahamas. And for any of you listeners who are going to be down here, look forward to having dinner with you and spending some time one-on-one. Till then, and until next week.
Same here. David, as always, a great pleasure speaking with you. You're really one of the most knowledgeable people that I have the pleasure of speaking with, and I'm looking forward to seeing you. And just a word to all of your listeners, you know, just because markets go down doesn't mean that you don't have great opportunities. In fact, bear markets have always been the best time for my business and for my own trading. You know, things go down faster than they go up, and so that means that you can make money much faster in a down market if you know how to do it. And with today's choice in the bear ETFs, you have a wonderful opportunity to really make money in bad times. And so the times may be bad, but that doesn't mean that you have to lose money. You can actually make money.
Bert, let me just suggest one thing. I mentioned I just come from a conference in Mexico. It was a closed-door session with 25 CEOs of global Fortune 500 companies. And it was interesting that in the midst of that conversation, one of them said, well, what do you think about, and they said, do you ever read the Wellington letter? What do you think about Bert Doman's recent comment about the dollar? And it just made me smile because here your name is popping into into the circle, and I thought this is fantastic. I hope that our listeners will take our conversation seriously and take your resource seriously. The Wellington Letter is second to none as a resource, and would encourage our listeners to reach out to you either online or by email and figure out how to be looking at that on a regular basis. DohmenCapital.com, if I'm correct, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's right.
DohmenCapital.com, and Bert will take care of you. A subscription to his letter is an absolute must, particularly in an environment where things seem utterly confusing and chaotic. You're talking about a market veteran who simply looks at this and smiles and says, yes, this too is an opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, David. I also want to point out we do have trading services that go out frequently for short-term traders where we give very specific recommendations on stocks and the...
Fantastic. Bert, we'll see you in a few days.
Okay. All right. Looking forward to it.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Bert Dohmen. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or feel free to call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.